Good morning. This is artist Eddie Campbell, illustrator of Alan Moore's From Hell, and you're listening to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. I'll see you in the future.
Good morning! Welcome to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours, episode 131 for September 29th, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflo.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
And we have reached the end of our second book in the book club. This is From Hell, which was published in 1999 by Alan Moore and Eddie Campbell. This is the end of the story, guys.
Steve, you survived.
I read this book, Chip. This is one of those book club books where I read this book, sir.
Well, that's the glowing endorsement we all look for. Pam, do you have a better endorsement than that?
Oh my gosh. I thought this book was awesome. And I am so grateful, Chip, that you have brought it to my attention. This book has been on my like gigantic to read book for probably 21 years since it was published in a full book form. I loved this book. And as you guys know, I study detective fiction. It's one of my areas.
Really? You've never mentioned.
Yes, I know. A bit shocked.
Chip is from North Carolina.
I've returned.
I am from Canada. But putting these things aside, so this is one of those books that, you know, it's kind of at the edge of detective fiction. Generically, it's a very complex book. It doesn't really fit into straight up detective fiction. It's not quite true crime. It's kind of one of these wonderful metafictional books that is looking at a super important narrative to 1880s, 1890s, late Victorian fiction that really gets picked up again and again and again throughout the 20th and into the 21st century. And it really starts to answer the, well, I shouldn't say answer. It poses the question and complicates the question. Why is Jack the Ripper so popular and so lasting in the imagination of the serial killer and of Victorian England? And man, this was such a perfect fit with Devil in the White City. And I know, Steve, your enjoyment of these books was very, very different.
Mm-hmm. But
together well, right? Like as
correct
pieces, they're wonderful together.
And that's what I said when we talked to Eddie Campbell last week, was this was the right book for the book club this month. I didn't love this book. Liked the reasonable art that Eddie was putting together. I loved the way that I could recognize the characters panel after panel. I admire his art. I did not like this writing.
Well, think about how this came to be. We're reading Devil in the White City. Our second book was really designed to be, it was going to be Brave New World. But I remember reading From Hell, and it had been a long, long time ago. And I said, we should read this next. And part of it is that Holmes, which Devil in the White City addresses, nobody knows who this guy is unless on some level you have read something about Chicago history, particularly the World's Fair and this mass murderer.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, Halloween's coming up. There will be somebody dressed as Jack the Ripper.
You think? I don't know that I've ever seen a Jack the Ripper Halloween costume. That's an interesting statement you made.
So what do we have here? We have a top hat, maybe, and a suit, and maybe something that kind of does. We know Jack the Ripper, who he is. It is. We have songs written about Jack the Ripper. We have. It'll play at some part somewhere. Anyway, we know about who this person is.
Chip, I completely disagree with that. So I think that Jack the Ripper is incredibly well known and yet not iconic. But let me just try that out for size. I actually don't think there's a standard Jack the Ripper costume. And like Steve, I've never seen anyone dressed as Jack the Ripper because we don't know who he was. And to me, that's what Alan Moore is suggesting, and that's what I would agree with, makes this character so fascinating, is that there's a blank space that is the visualization of Jack the Ripper. You could, I suppose, dress up as one of Jack's victims, but I'm not sure you could dress as Jack the Ripper.
Arthur Conan Doyle was suggesting it was a woman, right?
Well, exactly. And that's why I don't think you do have a costume. Like, we're going to see plenty of Sherlock Holmeses. We're going to see Draculas. We're going to see Frankensteins at Halloween. Well, depending what Halloween looks like this year, forgive me.
But historically.
Historical.
I just don't know that we'll see a Jack the Ripper costume. Because that's the whole point, is that we don't know who it was. No, Chip, respond to that.
We got, what we learned is that from DNA tests, and even personal DNA tests.
Boy, I love that story.
That story was so great. I'm so glad that I left that into last week's show.
I have told many people that story.
Eddie Campbell brought up Patricia Cornwell and the painting that somehow you could extract DNA from that. And, whether that's true or not, certainly we know the name Jack the Ripper. There will be stories written about this character. He shows up here and there. It's usually, somebody who is, a savage murderer.
And I think that's where the iconic piece comes in. I think Jack the Ripper as an identity is iconic, as the serial killer. When we think of serial killers historically, he's on the list.
And we can't forget that London, compared to Chicago at the time, was far greater. It was like the world city, like maybe what New York City is today. And they had newspapers that certainly made this character, these murders take a grander situation. I mean, they were trying to sell the danger. They're selling newspapers in Chicago. Chicago was still selling Chicago, like come to Chicago. On some level, they wanted to bury this.
The sensationalism of the writing of the day certainly sparked a lot of that feeling of this icon. And we saw a lot of that in the writing from Alan Moore here. He showed us that sensationalism of the journalism. We didn't get that in Chicago because these were unknown murders. This was not actively portrayed in the newspapers.
Wait, there's an Mason plot behind it?
Maybe.
But when we think about why Jack the Ripper remains such a well-known serial killer identity, I think we do have that notion that there's epistemological uncertainty. We don't know who Jack the Ripper was, and we never will, for sure, right? And so that allows us as readers to engage with the plot in a totally different way. When you're reading a detective story, you're in a competition with the detective to see if you can solve the case before the detective or with the detective, as we talked about in Sherlock Holmes. With Jack the Ripper, you're never going to know if you solved it. No one is. And there's something both annihilating and celebratory about that. That idea of what can we know? What are the limits of what humans can know? And this is something we're never going to know. It also invites conspiracy theories, right? That was one of the things that I thought was fascinating about From Hell, is this idea that the murder of these five prostitutes could have been linked to the most powerful people in the country, including Queen Victoria herself. Now, I think that's highly unlikely, but what an interesting thought that the data we have, you can fit around that story and make it make sense. That's pretty fascinating. You also have the conspiracy of the media. This notion that those letters from Jack the Ripper to the media, to the London Times, they could have been written by journalists just trying to sell a story. And that is a conspiracy theory that I'm far more willing to entertain.
So what we have here is that Alan Moore and Eddie Campbell, they tell you who the murderer is for this. Later on, they debunk it themselves. They're going to tell a story. And so we get William Gull as our murderer. We know from the very beginning, we have our conspiracy of Queen Victoria, that the Masons are part of this, that they've worked with the police department to cover this up, or with the leadership of the police department, who are also Masons. And then just sort of how they keep it quiet. And, once again, to come back to this, at the end of it, after all the notes, Alan Moore and Eddie Campbell sit there and say, okay, we just told you a story, and it's just, this was all just for fun. But this is the intellectual exercise of taking your imagination, taking the facts that are kind of out there, and putting together a, you know, a great story to tell around something that's a horrific part that, that just has enough of a hook that you'll want to come for the ride.
And all of those themes that we've talked about with the Victorian era are right in there in this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have this postmodern take where we accept that we're never going to know certain things on exactly the topics that we kept coming back to with Sherlock Holmes and that came up in Devil in the White City as well, which is that gender and sexuality angle. How do we think about prostitutes? What are ways that different people have thought about prostitution? It's a very open question in feminism. You know, does sex work have some sort of power or is it a purely exploitative industry? We get those questions of class, which get seriously played up in From Hell, right? Like to what degree, well, how vulnerable are women whose livelihood comes from the sex trade? And who benefits from their vulnerability? Is this something that upper class men can take advantage of? Also questions of urbanization. What happens when you have millions of people living completely separated from their own labor in this Marxist analysis, living in giant cities like London or Chicago? And again, who's vulnerable and how do those vulnerabilities play out?
This was the right book, Chip. Good job.
Well, that's right. The affirmations work out, right?
But Chip, like you, we were talking earlier about this question of urbanization. That's still something, urbanization and mobility, that we still talk about a lot today, like many of these topics, right?
And the 1800s, particularly the late 1800s, where we were still getting mass immigration into areas. What people were moving from one place to another, certainly looking for a better life. And, you know, a city like London is attracting people. So it's growing. You know, the trends today are not as hopeful, at least particularly in the United States. And there's some studies showing that our young people are not moving around. We still, in the United States, let's move to the United States. We're immigrating. We have lots of immigrants who are giving up wherever they're coming from. They're coming to the United States. They're hoping for a better life. But if you're here and you are you were born here and grew up here, that's one of the trends that should be something that we should just take notice of. Because if you move to an area, you're likely to stay there. You're not picking up and moving as easily as the people from Oklahoma picking up and moving west towards California because, you know, the Dust Bowl. You know, things of that nature was not working as well as it was. And for people who are going through hard times, many times other areas may have opportunities that where you're currently living do not. You know, they do not have those same type of opportunities for those. And that's why I kind of picked up a couple of just, you know, notes saying that the internal migration could be dampening. But the reason why we want to move is ultimately we're looking for opportunity. And what we were finding in this book from Hell is the risks that many people make. And if it didn't work out, prostitution is certainly, you know, I'm going to use the word opportunity that somebody could turn to, because at some point you have to live, you have to eat. And going to sleep on a clothesline, which we learned a little bit about here, having to make quick money to make rent or something of that nature is a very much a reality of a lot of situations. There wasn't a lot of social safety nets at the time. And the question is that, you know, what is proper for that? And does it create incentives not to move around to that?
Is that the source of why people aren't moving? Is there too much social safety nets that moving is such a process?
I don't know. I mean, this is what the trends I've seen. If you are a person who is starting a computer company, the founder of Yelp puts together resources for companies. So we all decide we're going to have a computer company. It looks like there's going to be an opportunity. The founder of Yelp has found us. What is he going to do? He's going to move us to San Francisco. San Francisco is incredibly expensive, but the reason why he does it is because that is where all those the intellectual resources for that area will help make our idea a reality if it makes it, if it's one of the lucky ones that makes it. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're not on that intellectual capability, or if those are, you know, you're on a much more modest needs, you may not move from that farm town, okay? Or maybe you move from the farm town to Chicago, but you don't move much farther than that. That would be troubling, because if your opportunity is in Atlanta, or your opportunity is in Phoenix, or if your opportunity is in Dallas, why shouldn't a group of people take that risk? Well, in the 1800s, the risk was incredibly deep. I mean, once again, we have from mental illness, we had the it looks like there was one of the prostitutes we met may have had some depression after losing a child. The husband and wife had an argument after a year or so. Certainly, it wouldn't be impossible to mourn for a year or so. They had a fight and she walks out. Mm-hmm. And she's got no place to go. Well, she doesn't have family in the area and stuff like that. They found a network of people who can support each other, but it's kind of a loose support. And their solution to their position was at prostitution. I'm going to add something to that based on the conversation we had last week with Eddie Campbell and with that Pam brought up. I had not considered this before this, but it certainly was eye-opening, is that we said, you know, this idea of adults making adult decisions, if you decided to have sexual relationship with a person outside marriage, that people would just throw you, say that you're a prostitute. I think Eddie Campbell said, you know, everybody can't be a prostitute in London, or something to that effect. That, but the idea of, you know, today is certainly we have a different thought on people having sexual relations than we did at the time.
And you're using the word people, but I think we're specifically talking about women here, aren't we?
In this story, yes.
In this time, yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Allowed to have sex outside of marriage. It's women who were not.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, but to be thrown in and that just because of that, you're now a prostitute. That doesn't seem to be a proper use of the definition.
Well, and the language has changed. So going back to why Jack the Ripper might remain such a well-known character, such a well-known historical figure, I think this question of how Jack the Ripper sort of emblematizes the city, right? These mm-hmm. are the dangers of urbanization. There's also a sort of some new paradigms around science, I think. And we've talked about this a lot in our investigation of Sherlock Holmes, is that in the Victorian period, there's a real conflict between science and religion that, you know, still, of course, has a legacy today. But this notion that Jack the Ripper may very well have been a doctor is, I think, one of the very attractive features of this character. And you will notice that Alan Moore brings up Robert Louis Stevenson's Jekyll and Hyde, this notion of the good doctor by day and the mass murderer by night, you know, mm-hmm. man. So the idea of the scientist as potentially bringing together both this notion of progress and health, but also having a dark underside, really does emblematize the Victorian anxiety around what you have to give up for science, which is possibly a religious worldview. And you'll also notice the character of the psychic was really interesting, right? And of course, at the end of this novel, the psychic's like, yeah, I have no evidence of an afterlife, despite the fact that I've done all of these readings. And so the psychic and the detective are talking together and they're both kind of like, yeah, we both don't know.
Our psychic, I want to say maybe it was the prologue, where he said, I made it all up. And the inspector says, oh, come on. Mm-hmm. And he goes, watch this. And he falls down the ground and shakes and shivers and stuff like that. And he goes, and sometimes I wet myself for
effect. Yeah.
Okay, and then later on in the story, we get the chapter where Gull has said something that's offensive to him. Like, Gull is saying, I'm the man of science. How dare you come to Queen Victoria and pretend you've got these powers? So he gives them kind of a slight in their introduction. From that, our clairvoyant recognizes that Gull is the murderer and basically leads the inspector or the police to his home. Mm-hmm. And that's just by being observant and basically using science. I was observant. I saw this, to go and pretend that he is a clairvoyant, that somehow he has these feelings.
I don't know if you guys have seen the television show Psych. It's probably a few years old now. I love that show. That's a total rewriting of Holmes and Watson. But that is the whole point of that show too, is that Psych is just like a very, very observant and smart guy who does this whole like psychic show in order to do the detective work that's really based on rational deduction.
Wait, are you saying that psychics are just putting on a show based on good observation?
That's the amazing Randy. That, you remember him, the comedian? He had a movie and basically spent his life debunking the supernatural powers that people had and showing them how they did their special gifts. Certainly, and Penn and Teller spend a lot of time. Basically, their whole act is, hey, listen, you're going to enjoy this, quote-unquote, magic, but if you ever really wanted to know how this is done, we're happy to sit there and explain how this trick is performed.
But then they add the next sentences, you probably don't want to know how this was performed. You want to live with the fun, the entertainment, and you don't want to see how the sausage is made.
You don't want to see it because you'll be bored of it, or maybe in your mind you don't want to really know. Mm-hmm. And I think you've just hit on what the late 1800s, and I shouldn't say this, the Enlightenment probably brought in. And maybe as a reminder that Newton spent, you know, who invented calculus, had all these wonderful, he spent his entire life trying to make gold. So even though, you know, the science is sort of there, we could easily, I mean, you could just see how this desire to kind of break the viewpoint of Aristotle of the world, this observation of the world, the scientific view of the world, we constantly are trying to break that and using supernatural stories, using religions and things of that nature, certainly try to help us understand what science may not be able to uncover. And there's sort of the magic of religion versus science and sort of how they may ultimately find their connection to each other, is that some things may not ever be able to be revealed.
And one of the things that's been really fascinating about the first 130 episodes of Sandwiches and Irregular Hours is that through Sherlock Holmes, as we went to Devil in the White City, now with From Hell, we're really looking at this periods of time, 120 years apart, right? Late Victorian period and today in 2020. And we're really thinking about like what has changed and what has stayed the same. And there are a lot of differences, but also a lot of similarities, especially epistemological similarities in the ways, the questions that we ask about the world, about what we know, how we know it. Much has changed, but much has remained the same. And as I was reading this, and especially the reflections at the end of this novel, it really did make me think about the Future Library Art Project, which is this project that I just think is so cool. It's in Norway. It started in 2014. And it's this idea of asking us to look 100 years ahead. So this is a project in which one writer per year contributes a book, a novel, a book of poetry, whatever that person specializes in, contributes a book that will only be opened in 2114. Now, one of my favorite writers, Margaret Atwood, contributed the first book in 2014. She wrote a book called Scribbler Moon, which I will never get to read because I will not be there at 2114 when we open the vault.
If the singularity happens, then there is a chance that your consciousness will have access to this material, Pam.
All right. Thank you, Steve. Keeping hope alive. But this idea of, like, I think it's super important, especially today when we're faced with so many environmental challenges, to think, like, what did the world look like 100 years ago? And what could we expect or predict it to look like 100 years from now? And I think that's a really important question. And in some ways, looking at something like an outlier, like the serial killer figure, someone who is outside of society, who doesn't participate in social norms and mores, it is a question, like, what did the serial killer look like 100 years ago? What does it look like now? What could that figure look like in the future? Well, it's just it's an interesting moment to be looking
playing
at.
With temporality. That is one of the themes that Alan Moore certainly plays with in most of his writing, is this idea of time. And I talk about this in my technology class all the time. Hey, kids, what does technology look like 10 years from now, much less 100? And what are jobs going to look like when my 11-year-old and 12-year-old say, hey, I'm going to be this job? I ask them, hey, is that going to be a job in 10 years or not?
A social media influencer?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you've just hit something on a topic that's really, it's difficult. It's very hard to predict what the future will ultimately be. And particularly as you go further and further out, it becomes even more, you know, you're dealing with, you know, a future that there's lots and lots of variables coming into play. In fact, I'm currently reading a book that talks about the way that we use information today, you know, particularly through Google, is very top down, and you're just a cog into this idea of trying to get your information. The writer is suggesting that that's going to change, and ultimately you are going to own your information. And you will have the ability to share that information either through a company buying the rights for it or you choosing it because you get some benefit for it. And that's a person looking in the future, making a decision. If you would have asked a person in 1970 what the future looks like, I don't know if they could have predicted a Google or predicted a Microsoft or an Apple or an Amazon.
Just the World Wide Web in general, just that innovation has revolutionized virtually everything we do.
You mean we don't live in Stanley Kubrick's 2001?
I did use the three seashells, but that's Demolition Man.
All right. Guys, can we talk about William Gull's death in Chapter 14? The final chapter of this. What did you guys think of this final chapter?
Well, I put in the my music, little lovemaking in the and as he died and it was going through his flashback. We've got this couple who are in the cell, kind of flirting with each other and making love against the wall.
And that was so interesting because I thought the notes in this chapter were especially helpful. And actually, Alan Moore's explanation for that was kind of interesting. He said that when his own mother was in a terminal ward, she could hear two staff members copulating as she was dying. And so he writes, and I'll quote, "Although at first surprised that anyone could choose a site in earshot of a bunch of dying cancer patients for their dangerous liaison, we eventually concluded that the very grimness of the setting might indeed provoke the need to affirm life in its most physical manifestation. Also, we both thought it was sort of funny, which is probably the only genuine reason for the scene's inclusion." And I thought, is both talking about Eddie and Alan, or
or his mother?
Or his mother and himself? I was like a little but
listen. Military people who are in combat positions and stuff like that, many of them have, you know, quote-unquote relations overseas or wherever they are. I'm assuming medical staff do. But a lot of it is that if you're faced with death quite a bit, there are people who, you know, they're making choices. This is their way of coping and surviving.
that affirmation of life. I like that idea. Boy, the juxtaposition. There's so many juxtapositions in this story. Oh boy.
It certainly helps you mirror your way to the reality of the situation, as opposed to what you optimistically may want out of life.
And that mirror is so well done. In chapter 3, we have a sexual liaison that is not romantic, and it is very similar, but at the same time very different from this final engagement.
It was a transaction. You know, two parties made a trade, where this one was a little bit different because while they certainly made a trade, they were flirting with each other, and they both, that's interesting to say, but while both parties chose in the sense of the prostitute to make the transaction, this was much more of a loving transaction.
Right. This one was about pleasure for both parties. Right.
And romance. Sure.
Uh-huh, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, there's nothing as romantic as that cell that William Gull is sitting
in. The man dying in the cell while this is happening.
But guys, the serial killer dying in the cell. I mean, I'm not saying that serial killers should die alone, but and they, of course, don't know who he is, but it does feel like within the novel, which obviously the whole Jack the Ripper case explores a really dark side of sex and sexuality. And there is something a little bit life affirming, as Alan Moore says, a little celebratory that like sex can be amazing. Sex can be pleasurable. Sex can be a way of two people coming together rather than a violation and an exploitation as it has been portrayed throughout most of this novel. And as it is in this story, of someone, quite possibly a wealthy white guy, taking the lives in a very, very disturbing way of women who were already very vulnerable and exploited. So I liked this ending for that reason. I think the notes made it kind of interesting, and the idea that they both thought it was funny, but also sort of celebratory, I think.
All right, we didn't put this in the notes, but I'm going to take it into a different part. Gull, didn't his father pass away and he was taken under? And then he just happened to be an exceptional scientist, so he became a medical doctor. And he rose and rose and rose. Eventually, you know, he became mad. But you saw that even under the monarchy and the Masons, he was disposable. And he made decisions that certainly scared those people for justifiable reasons. But what was their solution? Well, they locked him away to die so that, you know, he would cause no more harm. But it just shows you how even as a person could rise to a wealthy, respectable level, that under this story, then he also is as equally as disposable as his prostitutes.
Well, and that's what the second appendix, Dance of the Gull Catchers, I think is amazing, because it absolutely pulls that together, right? It says, look, we don't know that much about the Jack the Ripper story, but we do have a bunch of pieces. And Moore writes, quote, the main ingredients are established early. Later fictions will assemble them selectively in different combinations. And I love, as Eddie Campbell pointed out to us when we spoke to him last week, that there's a picture of Eddie and Alan, you know, talking about how they're going to write this text and thinking about how, which story they're going to tell. And they go with the Stephen Knight story, which is largely debunked. But that idea that you can take all these pieces, you have a certain number of things that you know, and there are a lot of different story combinations that you can weave around those, is kind of awesome.
It is brilliant. There's no doubt that this appendix, adding to the fiction, adding to the evidence at the same time, debunking each one, is brilliant here.
Well, isn't that also, if you're going to write a story that you know it's not true, you need to have enough truth in it that it kind of hooks you to kind of like, oh, this is plausible. And then you go on the journey. And even, you know, if it's flimsy at some point, as long as the story is told well, this is like I said, the mental exercise. This is how intellectually you get tickled in the brain, even though in your heart, you know, this is not true.
And I really like how in the debunking of the many, many Jack the Ripper stories, he also notes some of the themes that go throughout all of them. So, for example, he says a lot of the early narratives think about Mary Jane Kelly as the specific victim. And here's a quote. She'd infected Dr. Stanley's son, corrupted Olga Chirkov's sister. The underlying assumption remains unstated. She must have done something to deserve that. And it's almost put in there as almost like, I don't want to say humorous, but a semi-humorous note about like the foibles of human nature. But boy, it's really serious, right? It's really serious how until very, very recently, women who were victims of sexual assaults and sexual crimes were very, very often blamed for those crimes. And so there's something at once sort of like general, but also very specific and pointed about that analysis that 100% relates to 2020.
Well, very much so. Think of COVID-19, you know, is God making a statement on humanity? You know, I'm sure there's some group out there that's saying that we deserve this because, you know, we're not living, you know, whatever the moral standard is at that moment. And so this idea that a prostitute somehow deserves to be carved up and killed because she's chosen a profession and somehow justifying that statement as deserving seems to be a terrible way to look at life and how we should interact with each other.
And I thought it was interesting to see Conan Doyle referenced in this appendix as the one who initially said maybe a woman was responsible for these killings.
A little equal opportunity right there.
And we've spent some time with Conan Doyle and his representations of women.
although he, you know, Holmes has his adversary that is his equal.
Yeah.
That is
the woman, yeah.
That never shows up again. But, you know, for the...
Right.
And I thought the gull catcher metaphor was so great. This idea that they're trying to catch William Gull and then these people with these crazy nets above their heads. How in the world do you catch a seagull in a net? It just seemed totally absurd. And you know they're never going to succeed, just like we're never going to find the real story of Jack the Ripper.
And how subtle that is from the first panel of the dead gull is the story here. Well done.
Yeah. And I personally loved the very final panel as they're wrapping everything up. There's a woman doing an erotic dance. And the final line of this book is, we were looking at the naked woman dancing when it flew away. So again, this notion of magic, right? Of sleight of hand, of like, what are female sexuality as something that we pay so much attention to when all of these other things are going on? You know, maybe we don't have to worry so much about the fact that some women make a living through prostitution. Maybe there's a lot of other things going on that we should be paying attention to.
And the we there is not just Alan Moore and Eddie Campbell, but they are the ones in the illustration, right? That is the two of them watching this happen at the end.
So Eddie Campbell and Alan Moore chose to introduce the story as a comic. Alan Moore didn't sit down and say, I'm just going to write out a story in prose form. Do you think this story could have worked as well without Eddie Campbell's illustrations?
Certainly not. I mean, I think that because he took so much from Stephen Knight's book, that would have been very problematic. But also, I mean, the illustrations are awesome and they really, really enhance the text to me.
The fact that we chose this book instead of Stephen Knight's book tells me that, yes, the graphic nature of this graphic novel changes our perception of the story for sure.
Well, I read this maybe 20 years ago, and I read it with my eyes today. I have a deeper understanding of this book. It's amazing how you can revisit a story and your experiences in your life change how you view it. Mm-hmm. I think I will remember this story from our conversations on a deeper level. I remember reading it a long time ago. I remember enjoying it, and I remembered superficially this statement that Gull was the killer. First of all, I want to thank both of you for agreeing to read this. I'm glad I revisited this story.
And thank you for bringing it to my attention, at least. I really enjoyed this.
So now we've gone through my pick for the book club and Chip's pick for the book club, and we've seen them from very different perspectives. It's Pam's turn to bring a book for next month. So what are we reading for next week, Pam?
Oh, you guys know from our conversation in Sherlock Holmes, you know what it's time to read. It's October. It's 1897. We, my friends, are going to read Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Now, Dracul.
Now, this is a book that I've read many times and that I teach often. And so I know, like, my students always think they know this book because they've seen movies and they've worn the Halloween costumes and they know who Dracula is. But they end up really loving this book. Maybe you guys will, maybe you won't. But remind me, have you guys read the actual, like, 350-page Victorian three-volume blockbuster text, or do you guys just know Dracula from popular culture?
I know it mostly from popular culture, and my heritage from the Transylvania region, and my interesting food choices as a result that we'll get to in chapter one, by the way. I'll bring the chicken paprikash. But yes, I have read this at least once.
Are you going to do accents for us, Steve?
there's a whole rainbow of accents that will be happening when we start talking about Dracula next week.
I look forward to it. Chip?
Blah blah blah.
I don't say blah blah blah.
I think I've watched the movie last year or the year before for too much scrolling, but I don't think I've ever read the text.
Okay.
I am so glad we're going to read this. Once again, we're earlier in the 1800s, right? The mid part?
No, 1897. We're right at the cusp, right at the end of the period. And you guys, we're going to be talking about all the same technologies and trains and telegraphs and
and issues, all the same. This is all the same. You know, you should really study.
Could be a little
study...
sexuality and could be a little gender. You never know.
Yeah, you should study the late 1800s more, Pam.
Yeah, good suggestion, Steve. And don't you think I should just bring it to my friends?
and once again, we're going to a remote area. It is the late 1800s. And
anxieties about globalization and epistemology, my friends.
We're hitting many of the same tropes. In fact, it's almost as if our podcast book club has some tropes we're following.
And then we're going to...
There's no verisimilitude in this one, though.
There could be a little verisimilitude, but then we're going to change direction. So I'm so excited to be doing the last novel for a little while that focuses on this Victorian period. And then we're going to go in totally different directions.
We're going to have some howling dogs. I mean, Halloween's coming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
It is definitely October next week. I'm excited for this. This is one of those books that most people, you're right, have not read. They've seen the movie, maybe a couple of different versions of this story. And we'll get into that next week, how many different versions of this story and how iconic this story becomes. But I look forward to reading chapters 1 through 6 for next week.
And as you read Jonathan Harker's journal, which opens this, you don't have to picture Keanu Reeves.
I think that I do, actually. Whoa, the most righteous Claudio.
Oh boy, I can't wait for the Dracula accents. All right, so thanks again, Chip, for the awesome book suggestion. I hope you guys will like mine.
Oh, we're going to love it.
I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week from the dead.
Oh, boy.
Oh, that was good. Boy. I'm looking forward to it.
Excellent. We look forward to hearing from you. Hopefully you're going to read Dracula along with us. Hopefully you read From Hell along with us and you enjoyed it as much as we did. We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4867. Our website is sandwichesatirregularhours.com. Our email is sandwichesatirregularhours@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We're on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and YouTube. You can find us everywhere. I want to thank you again for listening to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. I'm Steve Fodor.
I am now Count Chip Hessensler.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
I thought you were going to say Count Chocula. We'll see you in the future.